Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And those are the voices of the Thursday Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks very much for tuning in. It is 9 minutes after 12 o'clock here on this Thursday afternoon. We'll talk to Dennis Rodkin a little bit later in the program. You know, so much time we spend talking to him about what's not selling and the prices that aren't rising. He's got a piece in Cranes on about personal real estate, about what types of property is moving pretty quickly. And it turns out two flats and three flats, things like that. Multi-million dollar homes, maybe not so much. But we'll talk to Dennis about what's working and how far away you've got to move to find a really heated up housing market. It is out there. But we start things off on Thursdays, if we're lucky, with Ian Schur from CNET, the senior editor there. He joins us on a phone line now. Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. You know, so I'm looking at some of the stuff on CNET. It's kind of exciting, maybe, to see that you're already writing about what's going to be hot on Black Friday or deals that are available and things like that. Something to look forward to, I guess, or to brace ourselves against. But I was interested in the David Carnoy story about Amazon offering a kids edition Kindle. My first reaction was like, well, you know, they're going to take advantage of kids by trying to market to them. But the more I look at it, the more it seems like it might be a pretty good idea.
Yeah, I think that what's really interesting is that Amazon seems to have a legitimate effort underway to offer kid-friendly and kid-safe technology. And when you consider that companies like YouTube and Twitter and Facebook have absolutely failed to offer products that protect kids from the nastier parts of the internet, it's really interesting to see Amazon trying. And this kids' version of the Kindle is like the black and white Kindle that all of us have tried at some point or another, I'm sure. It's not a full tablet, right? It's meant for reading with. It's designed to take a little more of a beating than the ones that we have. And it offers an unlimited subscription to all sorts of books and all sorts of other stuff that they think kids would like.
You know, what jumped out at me,
that's a really interesting idea.
What jumped out at me was the two-year guarantee, a replacement guarantee. When you're buying stuff
exactly.
for your kids, that works. Mm-hmm.
Well, and the thing is that Amazon's offered similar thoughts before. The kids' version of their Fire tablet, which is more of an iPad competitor, although it's much less capable, that comes with a really rubbery shell, and it's designed, again, to take that beating, and it has that kind of a protection plan. So I think we're going to start seeing Amazon push further and further because, frankly, no one else is offering technology that's designed for under 10-year-old kids. And that's a really important group of people.
And so the idea is that we try to keep technology maybe limited for our kids, but this is these are educational tools. They're reading books. This is the way people read books now. I think this is, I don't know, I'm kind of all for it. Although I've never read an e-book myself.
Well, you should get on that. But and you know, CNET has a bunch of ebooks, of course. But you know, the thing is that kids in schools now are actually expected to have tablets for their homework and for studying at home. So it's not just beneficial to have this technology. There's actually a need for it. And you know, while there is a lot of talk about screen time and all of that, having something is better than nothing when it comes to dealing with these things.
All right, so let's move then to augmented reality and the story about Apple, because, you know, I've been waiting for this virtual reality to come and it was going to change the world. It seems as if it slowed down quite a bit. But Apple is working on it's more of a set of goggles maybe than headgear, right? And that could be coming out soon?
Yeah, that's what we've heard. You know, we at CNET have heard that they're working on a headset that for next year, and that it's supposed to offer something similar. If you've ever seen the Microsoft HoloLens, it's this device that it looks like a very thick pair of glasses, and inside of it is a computer that overlays computer information on the real world. So imagine an arrow pointing you in the direction you're supposed to be walking down the street, or an email popping up to the side of your view, stuff like that. How Apple will do this will be very interesting, but the rumors are consistently pointing to next year, and they all seem to coalesce on this idea of the headset being whatever it is, right? Eyewear might be a good name for it, that whatever it is, that it will be a companion to the iPhone, which would be interesting as well.
So the idea is if the hardware is all on your phone, you don't have to put it in the headgear. The headgear can be much lighter and much more comfortable.
Yes, and a lot less dorky looking, which is the key problem right now that VR and AR has, is that these things are bulky. You don't want to walk down the street with them. You just look like an absolute nerd, and that's coming from a certified nerd here. So I think it'll be interesting to see how Apple goes about
it. So do you think when you put on the headgear that your nerdism is enhanced or decreased?
I think that it's actually... what happens is I lose my street cred by wearing it, right? Knowing about it is what makes me credible. Wearing it makes me look like a dork, I guess.
I want to talk to you, too, about Facebook. And there was a story about the Trump campaign had an ad up that the Biden campaign said was obviously patently false. And they went to Facebook and said, you need to take this down. This is false. We can prove that it's not true. And Facebook said, we can't. It's our policy is that we don't mess with politicians speak. Explain for me why they would take other people's posts down, but not a politician's.
Well, I think what's turning out here is that Facebook does not want to be the arbiter of truth. And in some way, I think we all agree that we don't want Mark Zuckerberg deciding what is true and not.
No.
The challenge is that when someone puts out something that is provably false, what do you do then? And when that person is the president of the United States, what do you do then? And that's the challenge, is that these companies don't want to be seen as silencing the president of the United States, or any president for that matter. But at the same time, they're dealing with this constant misinformation being sent out on the web. And it's hard to figure out what to do. The Biden campaign is complaining bitterly about this. By the way, they're also complaining to the New York Times and other people about this issue. And we're starting to see that there's this kind of culture war setting up where it's not just about misinformation from Russia and from trolls. It's about presidential candidates and about candidates for office sending out stuff that's questionable and what to do about it. But I'm really curious to see where it goes.
Can you flesh out for me, though, the Facebook policy? Yeah. Because they do, like, so if Donald Trump had retweeted something as a third party, they would be more inclined to take that down than if he were to post something himself, right?
The challenge, yeah, I mean, generally speaking, the only times that companies have taken down anything that President Trump in particular has said is when they violated copyright law. I don't know if you've noticed, but there are a couple of times on his Twitter feed, some fans will create a video that uses music from a movie or for something like that, and the company that made that music will issue a copyright strike saying, hey, we didn't get paid, we didn't authorize this song to be used in this campaign ad, please remove it, and Twitter will do that. But anything else, these companies really want to keep hands off. They don't want to be seen as the people who are silencing world leaders. And they say, look, if a world leader speaks, whether it's accurate or not, it's public information and the public has a right to know it. And in theory, that sounds like a very sensible decision. But when you deal with something where it's misinformation, then the question becomes, well, are you helping to spread propaganda? And what is your job then? Well, and I don't know what the real answer is.
It seems like, and I don't have the answer either, but it seems as if there's a difference between a politician, say Joe Biden, standing at the podium and speaking, that's, you know, first-person speech versus a campaign ad that is prepared for Joe Biden. It seems like if it's an ad and the ad is misleading or false, it seems like they would have a little more flexibility in taking that stuff down.
I think you're trying to split hairs, personally.
Really?
I don't. And the reason I say that is I think that these companies don't want to even deal with that. You know, it says at the end of the ad, I'm President Trump and I approve this message. As far as campaign law is, that means he said it. And so we have to deal with what the repercussions are of politicians saying misinformation on social networks. And that's the broader problem. I think whether it's an ad or whether it's a post or whatever, I don't think those things matter in this debate. Personally, and I don't think Facebook sees them as mattering either.
Ian Schur is the senior editor at CNET.com, and he doesn't mind when I split hairs. It was good to talk to you again.
Take care.
It's 12:21. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Bill Geiger is in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management, Chicago's retirement planning experts. Bill, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Good afternoon, sir.
Okay, so I was looking at this story in Barron's from earlier this year, and it took a look at retirement planning, right? And the idea is how we feel we're doing. Now, I think how we are doing is that none of us is really ready, or very few of us are ready. I was kind of surprised to see that the surveys found that 2/3 of us think we're ready for retirement.
Yeah, but it's really not true.
Right?
It's really not true. And that's the experience that we have when folks come into the office. It kind of falls in two different camps. Sometimes they think they're ready, and they're just like, what can we tweak to make things better?
Mm-hmm.
But a whole lot of times people are wondering, you know, are they on the right track? And just to couch us a little bit, you know, because we worked together for a while, that the focus of our firm, our specialization, is working with people that are real close to retirement.
Right, right.
We don't work with 30-year-olds, so it's different. So when folks come into our office, they're saying, you know, am I on the right track to retire? When can I retire? Do I have enough to retire? How am I going to replace my paychecks when they stop coming in, and will the money last? There's a lot of uncertainty.
I think that's probably, people want to know that, I think the idea of on track is mm-hmm. a key one there.
Yeah.
You know, people just want to know, okay, I'm going to put in my time. I know I'm not ready to do it now, but am I doing the things I need to do so that when it is my time, I can go?
And we also just talked before we came on the air that most people are planning on retiring around 65.
Yeah.
But the average retirement age, believe it or not, it's 61.
That shocked me when you said that.
Yeah, and it's 61 because people have medical problems that come up. They lose their job. Maybe they have a loved one they have to take care of, a mother or a father. And the average retirement age ends up being 61. So you may have 4 years less than what you kind of planned on to get ready.
And so, and of course, there are others who can never retire because they're not even close to being ready.
Yeah.
But those aren't the ones we're talking to.
No, it's not.
So sometimes I think going in for a meeting in a retirement planning session is a little bit like, you know, the castor oil. You know it would be good for you, but you're kind of afraid of it because you want to think you're on the right track. You don't want to be told you're not on the right track, right?
Well, I would flip the around a little bit. It's kind of sort of exciting.
If you got the good news.
Well, it's kind of sort of exciting because you're walking around with that little itch in the back of your head saying, you know, am I doing the right things? Am I on track? Is there anything else I could be doing? And Steve, what we do is a retirement readiness audit, if you will. And then we'll come out with a retirement readiness plan for the one or two or three things that they might tweak.
Right.
To really put themselves on the right track.
You know, I guess you're right. I was saying you put it off because you're afraid of bad news, but when you put it off, then that thing is sort of nagging at you in the back of your
head. Yeah, and when you actually understand where you're at and what you have to do, maybe liberating is too big a word, but I think it's true.
Well, I love the story you talked about, the couple who left your office and gave each other a big smooch outside because they were there.
Yeah, because they understood what they had to do and they understood that they were going to be okay.
Okay, so what happens if you're looking at this assessment? What is it that you know, if someone's ready or not, what sorts of things are you looking for?
Well, we look at do they have a source of income that they can depend upon? Because when the paychecks stop, they're going to be stopped for 20, 25, 30 years.
Right.
How do you replace that? How much risk do you have in a portfolio? Are you protected from the next big downturn? Have you scoped out exactly what it's going to cost you to live, or even in a ballpark area, what it's going to cost you on a monthly basis and get that together and have some plans for how to do that?
And so we talked earlier about maybe people think they're more prepared for retirement than they are.
Sometimes, yeah.
Sometimes. So I would imagine once they walk out, that once you know you have a strategy or a plan, it must be pretty reassuring.
Yeah, and we put these plans together. This is customized for each people. It's as unique as they are. And we put together a plan for their unique circumstances. And, you know, they might be taking care of a mother or a father for a few more years, that sort of thing. Steve, we're talking about the retirement readiness plan. Let's do something special.
Okay.
First five callers who call in with at least $500,000 saved for retirement, we're going to do this on a complimentary basis for people, customized just for them.
Bill Geiger, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, sir.
Thanks very much, Jordan Bernfield. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Dennis Rodkin is in the studio, writes about real estate, personal real estate. What's the right phrase? Is it personal real estate?
Private
residential real estate for Crane Chicago Business. Welcome back.
Thanks, Steve.
And so last time you were here, you really, well, you pretty much brought down everybody in the Chicago metro area.
This is what I'm paid to do, is
right.
to be depressing.
By talking about housing values and the fact that, you know, how we compare and things like that. So you have a new piece out, or a piece that's been published recently, about what is actually doing well.
Yeah.
Which, because things are doing well, and we can run down a number of them, but the interesting one that jumped out to me were two flats and three flats in the city.
Yeah. I was surprised by that. So the idea here is it's a weak market. It's not just a weak market in Chicago. It is nationally, though, as I've said in here several times, it's a little weaker in Chicago than in most cities. And there are reasons we can go into for that. But I started asking around, so what are the pockets that are doing well? And that's not just a location, but a
right.
concept. And an agent said something to me that I was a little skeptical about, but he gave me a bunch of examples. He sent me the forms. Nico Apostle, an agent in Lincoln Park, sent me these examples of two and three flats that are selling very, very quickly. He said if they have a good owner's unit, a good condition
sure.
owner's unit, they do really well. It's that, you know, this is a traditional, you and I both know, this was a traditional way to build household wealth, real estate wealth in Chicago. You buy the two flat, the three flat, you live in one unit, the rentals on the other one or two units defray your mortgage cost. You generate a lot of equity. The other two renters also generate equity on your behalf. Cuts down your costs. This has been going on for a very long time. It's going on now in part because Nico Apostle told me home prices are rising so fast that this is a way to get your foot in. And the other thing is you're not only defraying the cost of the mortgage, but the cost of the property taxes.
Right. And so these, the two flats and three flats, if they're in good condition, have a good owner's unit, are on the market only, what, 10, 11 days, some of them?
Yeah, he sent me several examples.
Wow.
I was surprised that they're selling in 10, 11 days, while the average around the city is well over 60 days.
West Loop condos, still very hot.
West Loop, I cannot even believe some of the numbers I've written about the West Loop.
I can't afford to visit there, let alone move in.
Exactly, yeah. And, of course, we've said in here before, it was once known as Skid Row. That's farther and
yeah.
farther into the rearview mirror. There was a $5.7 million sale that I think you and I talked about. There are two different buildings with multiple $2 million condo sales. There are literally dozens of million-dollar condo sales in the West Loop in the past year. It has really become not only a hot neighborhood for restaurants and that sort of thing, but for real estate investment. There's no other neighborhood in the city selling the number of million-dollar condos that West Loop, the
okay,
West
so
Loop
let's
is.
Go then from there. So we have the North Side, two flats. We've got the West Loop condos. You're talking about Bronzeville is doing well.
Yeah.
Mid-priced housing is doing well in many spots. But I'm interested in the exurbs, too. And it seems to be mostly south and southwest where the housing markets are pretty hot.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason for that is, you know, there are people who want to buy a house and there are people who have to buy a house. I want to buy a house because my kids have moved on. This house feels too big. We want room for a pool. We want to move up, that sort of thing. People who need to buy a house, we've just gotten married, we're starting a household, I need to move out of my parents' house, that sort of thing. And in many cases, these are people who need to buy as much house as they can for as little money as they can. And where that's going on now is these southwest suburbs.
So, like, where are we talking? Ottawa? Minooka?
Not as far out as Ottawa. I think they were Mokena, Bolingbrook, Wilmington.
Oh, Wilmington.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not Manteno yet? I grew up in Manteno, so...
I think that's probably going to hurt the real estate market for a long time.
Well, if they would take my picture off the welcome sign, I think
that's
that would
probably
do a
true.
Lot. Okay,
welcome
so,
to the place Steve Bertrand has never been.
Multi-million dollar mansions in the market overall are not doing very well, right? And you write about one on the north side, a 19th century building that is going to go for a steal.
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of a concept. It's going up for auction in early December. They have had it on the market for, first they had it on the market for $6.9 million. Over time, they cut the price to $5.4 million. It's going to go up for auction with a minimum bid, a published minimum bid of $3.35 million. And what a published minimum bid means is, well, first we have to talk about the other kind of auction, which has a reserve, where I put my home or something else up for auction, and I have a minimum below which I won't drop, but I'm not telling you bidders what that is.
Okay.
So I might, it might be that the top bid is $3.3 million, but I wouldn't sell the house for more than four. And I don't tell you that. I just say, no, this auction didn't conclude. In this case, according to the auctioneer, Rick Levin, they're actually publishing the minimum bid. Bids start at $3.35 million, which is...
So that means you're guaranteed if you bid that?
Yeah. The okay. top bidder over $3.35, gets the house. And that's more than $3 million below what the sellers have
so
into the house.
So are they just cutting their losses? Do you know the story with the owners?
The owners wouldn't talk to me. They've been trying to sell it for a couple of years. They have built another house in the suburbs, as I understand it. I think what they are doing is responding to the fact that the Gold Coast, like Lake Forest, has numerous mansions sitting on the market.
Right.
They want to stand out from the pack. Whether this is the way is a question. I asked another agent who said, well, the problem here is... Yes, there are all these other properties on the market, and people are waiting to see where the prices come down to. We don't really know what the market will bring them down to. But what she said is, if you say, I'll take as little as $3.35 million, then nobody will bid over... her feeling is nobody will bid over that amount. They'll say, well, they'll take $3.35 million. I'll offer that.
That's Dennis Rodkin, writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about maybe the ugliest house in Chicago. Well, that's coming up on the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Have you ever had an idea and you think it's great, then ended up seeing it on TV 20 minutes later? I've got it. A telephone without the cords. Introducing the phone you can take anywhere. The cellular phone. Ah, shucks. Similar situation is going on with the man who suggested the Cubs sell their ivy in a plexiglass case back in 1984. They both agreed to produce the souvenir product for a short time, stopped production, couldn't agree on a further partnership for more products, and then the Cubs brought the souvenir back into rotation after the 2016 World Series to cash in. As you might expect, the lawyers are chatting it out at the moment. And do you plan on visiting Disney World later this year? Well, you'll feel right at home when you stop by the newest Portillo's location, right outside America's favorite amusement park. The 7,800-square-foot restaurant is the third in Florida and will be open in late 2020. That might be the most American news you hear all day. So don't forget that chocolate cake shake before you leave. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Okay, so this summer, Sharon and I, my wife, we spent 4 days. We got an B&B on Dayton in Chicago and just kind of lived as Chicagoans for over our anniversary, right? Did a lot of fun things. One of the things we did is we had dinner outside at Bar Cocina, which is up on, I'm going to say, Sheffield and Wellington. And while we're sitting outside eating our tacos, we're looking at this building.
Oh.
And honestly, I'm looking at this building and we couldn't figure out what it was, if it was a small factory, if it was some sort of industrial complex. But turns out now it's on the pages of Crane Chicago Business and it's a house.
Yeah, it's a two-flat. Yeah, by the time you were looking at it, it was an empty two-flat.
Right.
It is this wild postmodern building. We have a limited number of postmodern houses in the city.
What does that mean, postmodern? Ugly?
To some people, it does.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It kind of wild.
Yeah.
You know, it's so modernism was very simple and clean line.
So whimsical, maybe?
Whimsical, yeah. In the 80s, if you think of like a house with shoulder pads, you know, this one has stripes. The bricks are laid in very visible stripes, black and brown, not just like black and less black. Lots of glass block, unusual angles. If you think of like the set design for the Bette Midler movie, Ruthless People.
Okay.
It's the sort of crazy, wild angles and pieces of buildings that don't really have a reason to be there. On this one, as you might have noticed, there's a wall that sort of extends up as a pyramid off another wall, and it really serves no purpose except to be looked at.
Well, it was odd looking at it, because we honestly talked about it because we couldn't figure out what it was.
Of course. And one of the reasons you and others had talked about it for so long is that it was built in the early 90s next to a surface parking lot. So there's this, on the sidewalk side, it's a narrow, kind of crazy look, but on the long side along that parking lot,
you see it all.
You see everything. You see the stripes. You see the weird angles. There's also this strange sort of It looks as if they put up some building materials and then sliced them off to make it look like it had eroded. It's a very wild, weird house.
If you want to take it in, you better hurry because it's probably going to be torn down.
It is going to be torn down. Yeah, it's I just referred to it as a house, but it is a two flat. It has two different entrances, and they are very different from one another. I mean, they really went all out building this in the early 90s. Bought by Advocate, which has Illinois Masonic right there, immediately east of this site, immediately east of the CTA tracks, is the big Illinois Masonic complex. Right. And so they bought both this and the commercial building next to it. And they didn't want to say, the demolition permit was issued. And so I called and said, so what are you doing there? This crazy two flat is going. What's going in its place? They wouldn't tell us. But it turns out that a website that tracks city permits found that they're building a 400 parking space building there instead.
Which will probably look a little bit better in the neighborhood.
It might. You'll have less to talk about when you have dinner.
Dennis Rodkin writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.